This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Paul David Pope. He's the author of a new book called The Deeds of My Fathers, How My Grandfather and Father Built New York and Created the Tabloid World of Today. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Well, it's really good to talk to you about this book. It is an amazingly interesting story, I think, for people who may not be familiar with, literally the people who you're writing about. Your grandfather was Generoso Antonio Pope, and your father was Generoso Paul Pope, but he was known as Gene, correct?
Yes, yes.
And, the story begins with Generoso, the first one who came to America in the early 20th century and kind of has this classic American story, but I think with some differences because he really, he kind of I'll let you talk about the story. But then, your father also has a pretty interesting story. I mean, it's an amazingly, kind of captivating story. You know, often you think of people's family stories as being interesting only to the family, but I think in this case it's got broader appeal. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, where it began with Generoso the First.
Absolutely. My grandfather, he came from a small hamlet in Italy called Arpaese. It's about 2 hours inland from Naples, and it's about 200 people. And he emigrated over in about 1905. Penniless, he didn't speak a word of English, and he started working in the sand pits, and eventually...
Talk about the sand pits, I don't want you to go too quickly over that, because I thought that was a really important point. And you painted this kind of scene of the work that they did. But Long Island is where the sand was dug that was then hauled over by barge to New York City to be used in making cement.
Yes.
And I thought, and he ended up kind of beginning really as the guy obviously had ambition. And, he had leadership qualities that are, maybe set him apart from others. But I thought the way you portrayed him in the sand pits was really interesting.
Well, in the sand pits, when he started working there, of course, it was a classic, rags to riches American dream where he had to, rise to the ranks. And, there was a lot of turmoil and certainly in the sand pits themselves back then. He wasn't readily accepted when he first started working there. So there were quite a few scenes and quite a few, a knife fight in one instance.
It was pretty rough and tumble, basically.
That would be an understatement, for sure.
Yeah, and I thought, also I was impressed, you think about it, he was not large of stature as you portrayed him. And he worked really hard. I mean, you think about these people... we look back on that era, it's over 100 years ago. I think about, baseball pitchers of that era would pitch 400 innings a year. Today they pitch 200. People who worked in the sand pits worked 8, 10, 12 hours a day digging sand, moving huge quantities of earth, by hand. These guys were just incredibly powerful, and if they were hurt... They didn't work. They didn't make any money.
There were
no benefits. There was no time. You didn't get time off for being sick. It's just an amazingly different world.
And as you said, his stature. I mean, he wasn't. He's probably 5'9", kind of stocky, but certainly not what you kind of picture as a stereotypical, laborer, if you will.
Right. He's not Paul Bunyan. But, I think that gives you a feel for the kind of guy that he was.
Oh, yeah.
And he is a pretty tough guy to not only survive, but rise up. And, he had big ambition. I don't want to tell the story for you, but obviously he was someone who, he had that fire in his belly.
Oh, yes, for sure. I think he had it from the second he left Arpaese. When I went back, I did a pilgrimage back to the town. in 2001, and no one in the Pope family had been back since 1937. And it was just, it was amazing to see the town, to smell the air, to walk the streets, to meet the people in the village, of course, that knew him. And it really gave me, again, a sense of who I am.
Well, now, as, I mean, I, and obviously we can talk about that later, you know, kind of what motivated you to write this, but, you know, you think back to this guy, so he's in this kind of the glory era of the building of New York, early 20th century into the 20s. He has relationships with the mob, shall we say. You know, Frank Costello was somebody he met when he was really young and stayed pretty, you know, stayed in touch with. You know, he was close to not only your grandfather but also your father. And but he, you know, he, you portray him as a pretty, you know, I would have to say ruthless guy, that he was willing to, you know, go after what he wanted, and if you weren't, you know, smarter or tougher to either stand in his way or beat him, he would take you, basically. And he built his business, which was the sand, the initial business anyway, was the sand business, by seeing that if he could take over one company and then build it into something bigger, he could put all the rest of his competition out of business. And what turned out is that he became the primary supplier of sand and other materials to the builders in New York.
And David, not only that, what was interesting, one of the things he sort of pioneered as well was the ready-made cement. So he was the one that invented the cement trucks, when you see them, that are mixing as they're traveling, you know?
Right. Oh, no, that's what we probably, people of my age probably grew up seeing those, especially in New York. They were,
sure.
You know, that's a kind of scene that you, you know, you see all the time now, but was definitely a marker for the building of big buildings.
Absolutely.
So, and of course, now I think they probably build houses.
Well, I think now the process is probably a little bit different, but
yeah, no, I know that there's a the cement industry is massive. It's huge. It's one of the biggest industries in America. I did an interview with another writer, a guy who wrote a book about the Golden Gate Bridge, Kevin Starr, and he talks about just the amount of building material that went into building that bridge. And of course, that's true of you know, so much of America. Cement is really kind of an it's an unromantic kind of material, but it's really at the root of almost every building in America.
You know, if you look at any emerging, you know, market or country, it's one of the fundamental things that has to occur.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Yeah.
That your father maybe was lucky that he realized it, but he was also smart. I mean, your grandfather, he was smart enough to really take advantage of the fact that cement is this, you know, critical component, and he was going to be supplying even the base material for that, which is sand. So so that kind of builds the base even for your family. You know, it's kind of, appropriate that, you know, he's the basis for it. Now, of course, he's, you know, there's a lot more about him. He's not exactly a lovable guy, and he did make some, shall we say, mistakes or judgmental errors over the years. You know, one of the things you talked about was his deep fondness and love for Mussolini. You know, which is obviously something you did not shy away from telling as, you know, a more difficult story.
One thing, David, in writing this book, I wanted to paint a fair, you know, portrait and picture of both men. And with my grandfather, whether it was Frank Costello or Mussolini, you know, isn't any kind of larger-than-life character. They always had their affiliations, although in the case of Frank Costello, that was his real-life godfather. So I view it as that. I mean, it was like going to your friend who's your godfather, not a godfather as, you know, like a mafia godfather, but just your true-life, you know, godparent, and saying, hey, I need a loan. Clearly, when my grandfather, you know, General Pope Sr., he became a power broker. So after the sand, the colonial sand and stone, he purchased a newspaper called Il Progresso, which was kind of the Bible for any Italian that emigrated over to the country that didn't speak English. And that was also a tie-in for Italy and Mussolini and a lot of the other politicians and people. So, and he acquired some other newspapers and holdings. So he really, you know, there's no doubt he was the most influential Italian American of sort of the early 1900s. But unlike the Rockefellers and other families, you don't hear the popes. And that was one of my things for writing this book, was to bring to light these men and their achievements, and truly they were both visionaries.
Well, actually, that raises an interesting point, and I think that's fair to ask. Why is it that, let's say, Generoso is not as well known? And even your father, I thought, you know, actually leaping ahead, his story is also really interesting. You know, he had to kind of deal with family dynamics, which was,
that was
incredibly, complicated. But, you know, he's also it's funny because, you know, the National Enquirer, which he founded, and you tell that story, pretty comprehensively, you know, that's something that you can see why maybe Generoso, the grandfather, not so well known. It's many years later. There's nothing romantic or public about sand and building materials, and even Il Progresso was a kind of, I don't want to say obsolete, but it's not something that everyone in America would know about today. But the National Enquirer, everybody does know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, I think both men, my father and my grandfather, made it a point to try, you know, to kind of stay under the radar. And they were not, they kind of shied away from the press. And that's the answer, really, why you didn't hear them. Of course, everyone's heard of the Enquirer. And clearly my father, you know, in starting the Enquirer, he, look what he did in not just the tabloid world, but it affects everything, whether it's CNN, the New York Post, it's kind of the format for everything we watch and see, whether it's internet, TV, print media. He changed the world we live in.
Well, it's true. He created, and we should talk about him a little bit because, he was a pretty singular and very complicated guy, and as you, there's the his imagination and ability to understand what an average person would respond to.
Well, I always say this is David. I always say I just used the quote that Nicholas Pudgy gave us, which was it's the story of the century. Because when I started writing this, I originally started writing the story on my father and just the National Enquirer. And I realized in doing that I couldn't tell that story without telling the story of my grandfather, because really he's the one that started it all. And then I went back and I started researching on my grandfather and all that. And it's really this story is one that I'm sure you've read it, but it reads like The Godfather, meets Citizen Kane.
Well, no, it is. I was sort of, I guess I will say, I was surprised that I liked it as much as I did. I read a lot of books, and the kind of idea of the story of a family, as I said earlier, it's surprising how compelling it was. So,
and it's interesting with both men. I mean, my father, for example, my father, typically wasn't the stereotypical tabloid owner, in the sense that he graduated MIT in 2.5 years with a mechanical engineering degree. He was in the CIA. So he was highly educated. He was, you kind of have this picture, as you mentioned earlier, David, with my grandfather and the sand, but, both men really were not the stereotypes of what you would think, but yet they achieved through enormous amount of family dynamics and, what they endured and persevered to create what the empires they created and the times they did is just, to me, it's remarkable. And it always gives me strength when I get stuck in life and I go, I kind of draw on their and the inspiration of what they did, and certainly myself. I'm a work in progress, and I've achieved. Maybe I'll be lucky in my lifetime if I achieve half of what they have. But they truly did amazing things. Which what they both did still echoes on and today with what they both done. Truly amazing. So I found this in writing this project to be incredibly cathartic, kind of. Really, as I've mentioned earlier, a sense of who I am and learning about these men that really, really changed our country and history.
Well, I think in particular the sort of the National Enquirer essentially, as you said, invented a form of media presentation of reality that didn't exist before. And of course, it was even controversial at the time when the National Enquirer was going through its really big period of growth, when your father got it onto supermarket checkout stands. That's really what I think was the key to the success. That was looked down upon by traditional journalism as kind of, you know, tacky, basically. And one of the things you talked about was that he was much more dedicated to the story and the facts than I think I would say Cal myself had. I had no clue. You know, I would assume that it was all basically made up stuff. You know, that's how we have thought of the Enquirer.
Well, David, let me tell you, I, growing up, of course, you can imagine I was teased and sort of tortured, about the two-headed babies and everything being fabricated. And in fact, as I'm sure you know, ultimately sort of people started to realize after we broke the Gary Hart story, that we finally started to receive positive recognition and being quoted by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, but in fact, all along, our journalism was probably the most accurate of any. And yet people thought the opposite. And it was nice to finally get that. And you know, even moving forward when the Enquirer was recently up for the Pulitzer, you know, our journalism was just, it was amazing. We sourced everything. We only lost one lawsuit, and we didn't have that many, by the way. And that was the Carol Burnett lawsuit. And we didn't lose it because we were wrong. We lose it because, you know, she had a empathetic jury, if you will.
Well, I think what a lot of publicity people realize is that they have something to gain from, you know, their clients appearing in the Enquirer. It's, you know, no matter what you say about people, it's good for them to get that kind of publicity. How often can you get in front of that many millions of people? There's sort of a symbiotic relationship, I think, between celebrities and even what is called the tabloid journalism. So it's actually good, you know, in a lot of ways. It's good for them. I also wanted to ask you about, you know, your role. You were obviously groomed to be the head of the next head after your father died, and I think he died unexpectedly.
Yes.
Apparently that was didn't work out exactly as you had hoped it would. How do you feel about what happened to you at that point? Obviously, you didn't get to continue the work that your father had started, and it sounds like you had really wanted to do that.
Well, that was, you know, let me start by saying that the newspaper was my father, or one and the same. You know, I mean, that was his baby, that was his life. I started working for my father at the age of 10, you know, loading newspapers onto the trucks, and, you know, till the day he died, I worked for him. So, I mean, that was my life. I didn't have a sort of a formal education like most people who didn't go to school. And so for me, when he passed and it was unexpected, I thought, of course, that I was going to take the paper over, as everybody thought. I didn't get it. I went through a really hard time, and everything happens for a reason in life. But at the time it was tough. But these things happen in life, and you have to move on. You can't live in the past. And it was unfortunate, I think, for a few reasons that you had these people that came in and the corporate raiders and the people that came in and they took the cash out of the company, bled the company of the cash, and took the company public, and they kind of didn't really care about the editorial sense so much and the morale, and they just changed it. So immediately raised the price very rapidly. And an interesting fact, they've managed to still do a pretty good job. But when my father passed away, the circulation was around 5 million. Of the Enquirer, and now I think the combined circulation of all the tabloids is right about 1.3 million. So, an interesting testimonial to his what he achieved.
True, although it may be that as you indicated before, the change in journalism.
Well, the times have changed. The internet. The change of sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think all print media is pretty challenged. Although who knows what he or you might have done. You might have done things differently. But you know, I noticed that you trained as an actor at one. Was that before or after you, you were working on the paper?
No, that was during my tenure. That I went over to London for about 6 months and I studied acting, and that was something I just had in my system that I had to do.
Have you ever acted professionally?
No. I went over there. I studied, and in fact, at the time, I worked in the London bureau for a while, and. Then I came back, so it was a short kind of stint, and it was an interesting one for sure.
Well, it's a really interesting book, and I think incredibly comprehensive. You spent how many years did you spend working on this?
I believe it or not, I've been doing this for 15 years on and off. I have to tell you this: I started off with what I thought would be about 50 interviews. We've done over 600, and I've got over 20,000 pictures. So. Essentially, CIA files, FBI files, presidential libraries, I'm really sitting on this treasure trove of material. We only ended up using, David, about 5% of it for the book. So in essence, I've kind of become like the family historian, the archivist, those different things, documentarian. And, there's definitely going to be a movie and many sort of other things that are going to happen from this. So, a book was important to me because it's a piece of history, and I wanted to do that first. And
no, it makes sense. Now, you mentioned just now that you become the family archivist, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about the family dynamic. I mean, you have, it's a very complex set of relationships. I'm not going to try to go over them all, but your father's brothers. Your grandfather's relationship to your father's older brothers, not good. But he really loved and cherished and kind of favored your father. And then there's the relationship with your grandmother, who lived to be very old, and she was kind of certainly complex in her relationships with family. Today, with all of the descendants of these people, where you had maybe some conflicts in earlier generations, how are people in your family today? How do they respond to this book? How do they feel about the work you've done? Is it all, have you become close with family members that you maybe didn't know otherwise?
Incredibly so. In fact, all the papas, as I call them, but, when my grandfather came over, he changed his name to Americanize it and changed it from Papa to Pope. I've become very close with them. In fact, one of the parallels that exists in this multi-generational saga is that the patriarch of each generation would choose a favorite child. So in the case of my grandfather, he chose my father, which inevitably created an enormous amount of sibling rivalry. And, of course, the same happened with me. So, I've managed, I call it breaking the chains. I'm now enjoying a excellent relationship with my mother. That's going incredibly well. I actually try to balance my work and different things with my children so that, at the end of the day, I feel the greatest legacy you're going to leave are your children. And I try to balance that a little more. But I always have to go back and be thankful to be able to do those types of things because of what my grandfather and my father did. I can't forget what they did, or I wouldn't be able to have the opportunity to spend the time I do with my children and things of that nature. So I think I try to instill in them, of course, they're young, these types of values. And certainly it's interesting because in my generation, I've kind of made an oath to myself that I will, as much as I can, and I think I've been very successful as breaking these chains and breaking these things that continue over the generations that perhaps aren't that healthy.
Yeah, I think that many of us are children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of immigrants, and when you look back on some of the things that happen in families, I don't know about, I see yours, I see mine, I don't know everybody's, but I think there have been a lot of very painful things that happened in those time periods that we have then you know, maybe the opportunity to undo or do differently.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good lesson that comes from reading some of the things that, you know, happened in...
And I encourage everybody to trace their roots, you know, for that very reason, because, you know, I think you can learn so much and not just for myself, but my children and, you know, all the future generations to come.
That's one of the great things about this book, and that is the amount of detail and kind of imagination you've applied to what happened. That I think is something that many people are cut off from, that they don't have the opportunity or they don't have the material, or
no.
Maybe they don't have the time or the means to figure out what actually happened.
Until I embarked on this, I really didn't know myself, and I looked at it as a three-pronged thing, kind of a celebration of my roots, if you will, a journey of self-discovery, and certainly a promise for the future.
Well, I think you succeeded, and I commend you for that, and I hope that you know, a lot of people will read this book. This has been David Wilkes for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Paul David Pope. He's the author of The Deeds of My Fathers, and the subtitle is How My Grandfather and Father Built New York and Created the Tabloid World of Today. It's a terrific book, and thank you very much.
Thank you, David.